This morning, we're going to talk about the trials of Jesus. We have been going through the Gospel of Mark in our Sunday morning sermons. This morning, we're going to begin in Mark chapter 14, in verse 53. Mark 14, picking up in verse 53. Jesus has been arrested in the garden. His disciples have fled from him. Even though they boasted that they would lay down their lives for him. Even though Peter had boasted, oh, well, if everyone else falls away, I will not. I will lay down my life for you. Well, Jesus has said that the shepherd will be struck and the sheep will be scattered. Jesus warned Peter that before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. And now we come to Mark chapter 14 and we pick up in verse 53 and Jesus has been arrested and now he is put on trial. In total, Jesus actually goes through six trials in the story of the gospel. Although no gospel has all six of them. He goes to the high priest Annas and then to Caiaphas. And then there's the official trial before the Sanhedrin to make everything legal because they didn't do it right the first two times. And then he goes to trial before Pilate and then before Herod and then before Pilate again. So there's kind of your basic framework for the chronology of what's going on in this story. Mark doesn't even tell you the name of the high priest, and I've always thought that was kind of interesting. In Matthew, he's named as Caiaphas, and we know from Luke and John that there was another high priest named Annas that was around at the time as well, but Mark just avoids the issue of the fact that there's multiple high priests by calling him the high priest. And in Mark chapter 14, picking up in verse 53, they led Jesus away to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes gathered together. Peter had followed him at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the officers and warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain testimony against Jesus to put him to death, and they were not finding any. For many were giving false testimony against him, but their testimony was not consistent. Some stood up and began to give false testimony against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another one made without hands.'" Not even in this respect was their testimony consistent. The high priest stood up and came forward and questioned Jesus, saying, "Do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you?" But he kept silent and did not answer. Again, the high priest was questioning him and saying to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" And Jesus said, "I am. You shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Tearing his clothes, the high priest said, "What further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. How does it seem to you?" And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. Some began to spit at him and to blindfold him and to beat him with their fists and to say to him, "Prophesy." And the officers received him with slaps in the face. So here Jesus is brought before the high priest. Peter is following at a distance, but not part of the group anymore. He had claimed he would not fall away in verse 29, even if everyone else did. Is Peter going to do that? You know, he's following Jesus so he can be that one disciple who doesn't fall away. Well, of course, his real weakness will soon be exposed, and he will be forced to flee. We read last week in the verses 51 and 52, the bizarre story of the man who was wrapped in a sheet and he was following and then he got seized and he ran and he escaped naked. Well, Peter's going to have to flee in very similar fashion soon. Peter gets into the court. He sits by the fire. He warms himself with the other officers. He manages to get right into the high priest's court. And here is an opportunity to rise to Jesus' defense as his disciple. This is where the so-called trial takes place. And Peter can defend him to the point of death, fulfilling his boast. But does he do it? No. Luke's account in Luke 22 and verse 61 actually indicates that Jesus is within eyeshot of Peter. Because after Peter denies him the third time, Jesus turns and looks at him, the text says. You know, they were somehow able to see each other during all of these proceedings. But Peter does not rise to his defense. The trial is a sham. It's the ultimate example of what we call kangaroo court. The chief priests, the Sanhedrin, they're all sitting around. They're trying to get testimony against Jesus. They're trying to kill him. They've already decided what they want the verdict to be. They just need a charge to fit the verdict. And they just need evidence to fit the verdict. And since if they don't have it, the best thing to do when you don't have evidence to fit your conclusion is to make something up. Well, that's what they're doing here with Jesus. And the problem, of course, is if they want testimony to put Jesus to death, they have to make something up because Jesus hasn't actually committed any capital crimes. In fact, they can't seem to get him on anything at all. And it creates a highly embarrassing situation for the council because they've decided the outcome of the trial, but they haven't figured out what to charge him with. And they can't craft the evidence to fit it. And all the people who are coming in and giving testimony can't seem to get the story straight. All inconsistent. This is some conspiracy. I mean, they've been plotting, you know, this whole time since the beginning of the chapter. We're going to put Jesus to death. We're going to figure out how to do this. We're so clever. We're making sure we don't do it during the feast because of the people. We're going to do it in secret. We're going to get one of his disciples to turn him over. But then comes the trial and, well, they're a bunch of buffoons, basically. They can't get the story straight. They don't have anything solid to work with. Finally, they get one quote. Oh, he said he was going to destroy our temple. Or get him on vandalism. Or desecration, or whatever it is. We heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without hands. But not even the witnesses to that statement can get the story straight. Now, did Jesus ever say that? And funnily enough, Jesus does make that statement, but it's never recorded in the Gospel of Mark. It's recorded in the Gospel of John, in John chapter 2. And it wasn't a precise quote, because what he said was, they asked him for a sign, and he said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And John indicates in John chapter 2 that he wasn't even talking about the physical temple. He was talking about the temple of his body, predicting his death and his resurrection, and so on. So, you know, he wasn't really talking about the physical temple, despite their misquotation of what he says. Now, in Mark, he did tell the disciples in Mark 13, do you see these great buildings? Not one will be stone will be left upon another, which will not be torn down. Jesus is going to destroy the temple. That's not what he said. What he said was not one stone will be left upon another, which will not be torn down. So, they can't get the story straight. Maybe just all these conflicting issues about what Jesus said and when he said it and what he meant when he said it is the reason why they can't get their testimony to be consistent with itself. Finally, the high priest gets the idea, well, why don't we badger Jesus for answers? He's not answering any of these charges. He's keeping his mouth shut. You have no answer? What is it that these men are testifying? But verse 61, Jesus keeps silent. Why, Jesus? Why keep silent? Isaiah the prophet spoke about this. In Isaiah 53, speaking of the suffering servant who was to bear the sins of the people, he said in Isaiah 53 and verse 7 that he was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, so he did not open his mouth. He kept silent. The book of Proverbs, in Proverbs 17, there's this statement made, picking up in verse 27. He who restrains his words has knowledge. He who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. Even a fool, when he keeps silent, is considered wise. When he closes his lips, he is considered prudent. He who separates himself seeks his own desire. He quarrels against all sound wisdom. There's no lessons that preachers could ever learn from this at all. No. The modern day equivalent, you know, better to be silent and be thought a fool than to open your mouth and remove all doubt, something like that. But the whole idea is that the wise man is the one who restrains his lips. He doesn't say everything he thinks. Jesus, he's the wise man who doesn't restrain, who doesn't just open his mouth and answer. He restrains his lips. And he, like the lamb led to the slaughter, does not open his mouth. He does not offer threats. He doesn't give snappy comebacks like, you know, any of us would like to do in these situations. He doesn't even try to refute the nonsense that people are throwing at him. Instead, what happens? He entrusts himself. Entrusts himself to who? Entrusts himself to the righteous judge. But the judges in this scene are not righteous. Well, he entrusts himself to the righteous judge. In 1 Peter chapter 2, in verse 23, Peter reminds us that while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. 1 Peter 2, verse 23. Imitation of Jesus is a hard thing. We're supposed to take up our cross and follow him. We're supposed to be Christ-like. We're supposed to follow after Christ. Sometimes imitation of Jesus means that we don't feel compelled to refute every person who's wrong about stuff. That's a hard lesson for me to learn. Because I see someone who's wrong. I see someone who's wrong on the internet. And my first instinct is to jump on them and be like, I got to deal with this. I got to fix this. But that's the wrong way to look at it. Because that's not what Jesus' approach is in these situations. And so often, half the time I'm probably the one that's wrong about it anyway. But that's not wisdom. That's not how wisdom acts. Wisdom restrains words. That's not how Christ acts. Christ didn't feel the need to respond to all of this stuff. Do you think that Jesus could have refuted these charges? Well, of course he could have. I mean, we've already established that Jesus is very good at winning arguments. Remember chapter 12? All those questions they had, those little trick questions they had to trap him? He had no problem putting those people down and then asking his own questions to trap them. Could he do that at this trial? Of course he could have. He's Jesus. He's God in the flesh. He has every way imaginable to get out of it. He could summon an army of angels, like Matthew talks about, to destroy the people in this proceedings if he didn't feel like arguing with them. But he doesn't do that either. He lets them get away with this. He lets them go on their wrong course. He lets them go on with this sham. Finally, they ask him a direct question. Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? Which is the main claim of the book, the very beginning of the Gospel of Mark in chapter 1 and verse 1. This is the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus, the Christ, the Son of God. It was the confession that Peter made. You are the Christ. It's the confession that the Roman centurion will later make. You are the Son of... Well, this man was surely the Son of God. And Jesus' response? I am. Only time in the entire book where Jesus actually agrees with the claim that he is... Well, not, I say agrees. It's the only time where Jesus actually explicitly says, yes, that's me. And I am the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One. Oh, and by the way, throws in a few extra things. You will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power. That's an allusion to the 110th Psalm. He will come with the clouds of heaven. Daniel 7, verse 13, talks about the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven to judge the nations. All quotes Old Testament passages about the Messiah, the Son of Man, and how he defeats the nations and establishes his own kingdom, and you're going to see that. Well, there's no better way to make someone mad than quote scripture at them. It happens. I mean, I've been in those situations before. Again, when you're arguing on the internet and you shouldn't do that, and all I did was quote, I just gave a list of scriptures, and somebody got really angry. How dare you quote all those things? And I go, why? It's the Bible. It's amazing how that generates such a verbose response. Since Jesus is the only person in this trial to tell the truth, he's condemned to death. The high priest tears his robes and says, "What further need do we have of witnesses?" And this is a legal principle that you can find elsewhere in Scripture. Normally, when you executed somebody for a capital crime, you needed two witnesses or three witnesses. Deuteronomy was very clear on that point. A single witness cannot rise up against a man to put him to death. Deuteronomy 17 and verse 6. Deuteronomy 19 and verse 15. But there was an exception to this rule. If the person actually confessed to the crime, then they could be put to death. We see an example of that in 2 Samuel, for instance. In 2 Samuel, an Amalekite shows up after the death of Saul and tells David that he killed Saul. And we as the reader know, of course, the Amalekite did no such thing because Saul fell on his own sword in the prior chapter. So this guy's basically lying. Why would he lie? What motivation would he have to lie? Well, he wants to get into David's good graces by claiming he killed Saul so that you could be the king, David. And, of course, the whole thing backfires on him. Because David says in verse 14 of 2 Samuel 1, "How is it that you were not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" And David called out one of the young men and said to him, "Go cut him down." So he struck him and he died. David said to him, "Your blood is on your own head, for your mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" So if someone confesses to a crime outright, apparently they can be executed for it. No witnesses required. Of course, in this instance, it's somebody who didn't even commit the crime. So be careful what you admit to doing. But here, the high priest cites the same idea. Well, you've heard it from his mouth. You've heard the blasphemy. Everyone here is now a witness. It's hard to see how what Jesus says is actually blasphemy unless it's not true. It's like, are you the Christ, the Son of God? Yes. He's blaspheming. Clearly he's not. So if he says he is, we must condemn him somehow. Well, we might say that to somebody who made such a claim today. But because it's true, well, it isn't blasphemy. Jesus has demonstrated time and time again through various signs and miracles and wonders and powers that he is the Christ, the Son of God. And he hasn't been going around telling this to people. He's just been acting in such a way that, you know, the careful observer would have been able to figure it out for themselves. But now, those too stubborn to see the truth hear these words and think only blasphemy. Blasphemy in the law was a capital crime. Leviticus 24, verse 16 says that the one who blasphemes the name of Yahweh shall be put to death. And having condemned him to death, they begin to treat him violently. They spit on him. They blindfold him. They beat him while blindfolded as a form of mockery. Worst game of guess who ever. Matthew and Luke clarify, by prophecy they mean to tell us, who is the one who hit you? You hit him in the face. Well, you're so smart, Jesus. You can prophesy. Who's the one that hit you? Of course, the irony, we as readers already know. Jesus can tell you who's hitting him because he can do that because he's God in the flesh. But Jesus doesn't answer their questions. He doesn't play their game. You know, could he have gotten out of it if he had accurately stated, oh, yes, that guy, that guy, that guy? But he doesn't answer their questions. As a lamb led to the slaughter, he does not open his mouth. Why? Why endure this? Why not destroy these people? Why not crush them? Why is it that the one who commands the unclean spirits and the wild waves of the sea takes slaps in the face from these nobodies? Because Jesus is living out his own commission. That's why. Because of what Jesus said in Mark 9 and verse 35 is true of him when he called the 12 and said that if anyone wants to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all. Jesus takes this. He allows himself to be last of all so that he can be the greatest of all. While all this is going on, in verse 66, Jesus' disciple, Peter, who once confessed him to be the Christ, is now denying that he has any connection with him. Verse 66, as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came, and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, "You also were with Jesus the Nazarene." But he denied it, saying, "I neither know nor understand what you're talking about." He went out onto the porch, and a rooster crowed. The servant girl saw him and began once more to say to the bystanders, "This is one of them." But again he denied it, and after a short while the bystanders were again saying to Peter, "Surely you are one of them too, for you're a Galilean too." But he began to curse and swear, "I do not know this man about you are talking about." And immediately a rooster crowed a second time. And Peter remembered how Jesus had made the remark to him, "Before a rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." He began to weep. All the Gospels agree that Peter denied Jesus three times, though there are little details that are different if you read the stories side by side. And usually the main differences come from who is Peter speaking to when he denies Jesus, or rather, who is Peter responding to. And probably the simplest way to reconcile all that is to say that, well, a bunch of different people say something, and he denies them, and then a bunch of different people say something else, and then he denies them again, and... she makes this point, "You were with Jesus the Nazarene." Is that an accusation? Is that a mere statement of fact? Is that simply a lucky guess on her part? We don't know. Her motives are irrelevant. What matters is Peter's response. Peter denies being with Jesus. He claims he doesn't know. Doesn't understand what she's talking about. She sees him again. This time starts telling the bystanders, "This is one of them." Peter denies it again. And then the bystanders start saying to Peter, "Well, you're a Galilean too. And since all Galileans must know each other, you must know Jesus." Right? Well, in the Matthew's account, the reason they know this is because his accent gives him away. Matthew 26:73, "Even the way you talk gives you away." Peter starts cursing and swearing, "I do not know what you're talking about." Well, why does Peter go so far as that? I heard a sermon once, somebody said, "Well, there you go. There's proof that Peter... Peter's fisherman, salty sailor talk was finally coming out of him. Well, that's not what's going on here. When the Bible talks about cursing and swearing, what it's talking about is oath-taking, placing somebody under a curse. He takes this, you know, he swears this oath that he really doesn't know Jesus and puts himself under a curse. He doesn't really know Jesus, which is a really rash vow to make considering it's not true. And then he gets the worst wake-up call ever when the rooster crows for the second time. Peter remembers what Jesus told him. Before a rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times. Peter went out and wept bitterly. He didn't fulfill his boast. He fulfilled Jesus' predictions. You remember what Jesus said back in Mark chapter 8? If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Peter didn't take up his cross to follow Jesus. In verse 35, whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the Gospels will save it. Well, Peter's trying to save his own life here. Verse 38, whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with his holy angels. Peter is ashamed of Jesus, ashamed to admit that he knows him. That doesn't bode well for Peter. The man who confessed Christ, who rebuked Christ for suggesting that he would go to the cross, who boldly proclaimed that he would stand faithful even after all others had fallen away, he himself fell away. And Peter's not in the story so that we can go, well, tusk, tusk, I'm so much better than Peter. No! Peter's in the story to remind us of something. If there's hope for him, then there's hope for any of us. If he can come back from this, any of us can come back from this. But for that hope, we must feel the sorrow and the revulsion for our sin that Peter feels. Peter doesn't try to hand wave his denials. He weeps bitterly because he realizes the horror and the magnitude of his behavior. Then we come to the third trial. Well, we come to this trial, rather. Trial before Pilate. Early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders and the scribes and the whole council immediately held a consultation. And binding Jesus, they led him away and delivered him to Pilate. Pilate questioned him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" He answered him, "It is as you say." The chief priests began to accuse him harshly, and then Pilate questioned him again, saying, "Do you not answer? See how many charges they bring against you?" But Jesus made no further answer, so Pilate was amazed. At the feast, he used to release for them any one prisoner whom they requested. The man named Barabbas had been imprisoned with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the insurrection. The crowd went up and began asking him to do as he had been accustomed to do for them. And Pilate answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" For he was aware the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to ask for him to release Barabbas for them instead. Answering again, Pilate said to them, "Then what shall I do with him whom you call the king of the Jews?" They shouted back, "Crucify him!" But Pilate said to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Crucify him!" And wishing to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas for them, and after having Jesus scourged, he handed him over to be crucified. There's a passing remark in verse 1 that the Sanhedrin held a consultation. They got to have a real trial, because what they were doing in the middle of the night was against procedure. They needed an official trial to get everything on the record and actually condemn Jesus to death. And Jesus is bound and led away to Pilate. But why do we need Pilate? Well, the reason why is, you know, because, you know, normally, you know, if this were just the Jews, they could just put him to death by stoning. But the problem is that the Roman government had imperium. They had the right of the sword. And because they had the right of the sword, the Jews were not permitted to put anyone to death without going through that due process. Sometimes they violate that procedure, like when they stoned Stephen in Acts 7. But they got to go through their Roman courts. Their law, even if their law would have judged somebody worthy of death, John 18, verse 30 and 31 says, you guys' law don't permit us to put anyone to death. And everything changes in the trial before Pilate. Before, the charge was blasphemy. Now it's insurrection. Because, you know, Pilate's not going to care about blasphemy. He's Roman. He doesn't care about any of their religious stuff. Throughout the chapter, Jesus' greatest crime that he is accused of, well, it's not really clear what the charge is in this chapter. Because the only question Pilate has for him is, "Are you the king of the Jews? We're putting him on trial for being a king." And while Mark has talked quite a bit about the kingdom, this is the first time that Jesus is explicitly called a king in chapter 15 and verse 2, when Pilate asks, is he the king of the Jews? And from here, Jesus is called king six times in the span of this chapter. A bizarre time for someone to finally start calling Jesus king, right when he's about to be condemned, right when he's about to be executed. Normally the king is the one doing the executing, not the one being condemned to die. Normally kings are leading violent insurrections to establish their kingdom. What king do you know of who starts his kingdom by dying for it? I can only think of one, and it's Jesus. Pilate asks Jesus point blank if he is the king of the Jews, and Jesus, just like before, does not answer. Keeps his mouth silent. The chief priests start hurling their accusations at him more violently, and Pilate is amazed at his silence. He says, don't you see these charges? Are you really not going to give an answer to these people? And then Pilate gets this idea. Well, we do have this Passover tradition. We always release a prisoner during the Passover. Maybe I can get the crowd to call for Jesus' release. Because I know that this is mainly the chief priests, and they're envious of him, and they want to get rid of him. But the crowds, Jesus is, you know, pretty popular with the crowds. So I'll offer to release Jesus to the crowds, and of course they'll roll with this, right? But then the chief priests, as it turns out, they stir up the crowds to ask for Barabbas instead. Barabbas, most creatively named person ever. His name means son of the father, Barabbas. Okay, Junior. Barabbas is an actual insurrectionist who is in jail for the reason that they're trying to get Jesus killed, or at least their stated reason. And as a result of all of this exchange, what happens? They release Barabbas and they condemn the king. What shall I do with the one you call king of the Jews? What's the fate worthy of a king? How about nailing him to a piece of wood to die in public exposure? Crucify him, the crowd says. Well, crucifixion, that's a pretty tall order, don't you think? I mean, what has he done to deserve that? Why should I crucify him? What evil has he done? What charge do you have? Are we seriously going to condemn a man to the most shameful method of execution without some kind of concrete charge against him? You know what the crowd's answer is? Crucify him! They took debating lessons from people living in our generation. And just repeat yourself louder and louder until you get your way. Pilate can't get a word in edgewise, and Jesus was crucified because a group of people shouted louder and louder until they got their way. Mob violence. Justice is perverted and overturned. And Pilate gives up. In the end, he just caves to the whims of the crowd. In the end, he's no better than the chief priests who base their actions on the whims of the crowd. You know, people try very hard to vindicate Pilate. Not in this story. He's just like the chief priests. They're afraid of the people. Everything they do is done because we're afraid of the people. We're afraid of our reputation among the people. Pilate does what he does out of fear of the people. Barabbas gets released. Jesus is handed over to be scourged and crucified. The king is condemned. The trials of Jesus, I said this lesson is about trials, but are these really trials? It's kind of a mockery of actual trials to call them such. It's a kangaroo court of injustice. An innocent man, condemned by a world not fit to judge him. Jesus is the king. He should have been the one condemning the world, but the world condemns him instead. Jesus is the one who commanded the unclean spirits. Jesus is the one who commanded the waves to be still, and they listened to him. Jesus is the one who spoke to the dead girl, little girl, arise, and she rose up. He can command all of these things. His authority, his power has been demonstrated time and time again. But he refused to speak here to the crowd. We know he could have. Could have been so easy. Stop the raucous injustice. But he doesn't open his mouth. He goes to the cross. He dies as a selfless, silent, sacrificial, suffering servant. Why does he do that? Because he loved us. That's why. Because as a king, He doesn't lord it over others. He makes himself last of all. And how much more should we who profess to follow him humble ourselves and submit ourselves? It's a perspective change for us. Not to focus on constantly getting our way all the time, constantly asserting our position and our dominance. The world says, grab all the gusto you can get. Get what you deserve. Don't let other people push you around. But Jesus calls on us to turn the other cheek, to not have to answer every argument, to sacrifice ourselves willingly for others, even if they don't deserve it. Because how much less did we deserve what he did for us? May God help us to learn his example. You might be here this morning and you're not walking in the footsteps of Jesus. We speak about baptism being conformity to his death, his burial, and his resurrection. And that is true. And if that is not you this morning, that's certainly something you need to do. Our lives need to be conformity to his death and his burial and his resurrection as well. He said, if anyone wants to be great among you, he must be a servant. Whoever wants to be first among you must be slave of all. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus didn't just say those words. He lived them. And we're seeing it unfold as we read these stories about him going to the cross, going through these trials, going through this undeserved suffering, unjust. Well, it's not fair, we might say, of our lives. But none of us can say it's less fair for us than it was for Jesus. If you're here this morning and your life is not right with the Lord, you're not walking in the footsteps of Jesus and you need to restore yourself to the Lord or perhaps join yourself to him for the first time, now is an appropriate time to let that need be known while together we stand and we sing the song that was selected.
meetings is available. The sound booth in the back. If you'd like a copy, you feel free to pick one up. And please remember, as we pray from time to time, I'm sick and I'm afflicted, and those who are in prison, etc., having a difficult time, we all need prayer.